way Americans produce and consume energy is on the brink of a revolution, according to a new study by Bloomberg New Energy Finance. This year is poised to be a record-breaking year for renewable energy, and solar energy is at the center of this transformation. In his new book, Harness the Sun, America's Quest for a Solar-Powered Future, renewable energy writer and speaker Philip Warburg tells the story of solar energy's dramatic rise and the challenges facing its future. Again, the title of the book is Harness the Sun, and we welcome Philip Warburg to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Happy to be on your show.
When we talk about this transformation, how did we get here? Because it's been a long road, hasn't it, for solar?
It really has. We first began exploring solar really back in the 1970s, and there was a moment there where we thought we were on the road to a renewable energy future under President Jimmy Carter. A lot of the incentives that were put in place under the Carter administration vanished during the Reagan years. And even by 2012, when I was finishing writing a book about wind power, people would ask me if my next book would be about solar, and I would respond by saying that if I ever wrote a book about solar, I'd have to call it Dim Sun. That has changed very dramatically since that time. The price of solar has come way down. As one very dramatic indicator, in the first 6 months of this year, solar energy has accounted for 39% of all new installed electric generating capacity nationwide. And if you add to that wind power, you get to 75% of our new generating capacity during the first half of this year coming from those two renewable energy resources alone. So when people talk about gas as the transitional fuel that will be with us for decades, it may be with us at some level, but gas during that same period accounted for about 21.4% of our new generating capacity. So solar has really come off the sidelines and onto the field and is a real player for a whole variety of reasons.
So let's explore some of those reasons of what turned us around as a society, as a culture, to look to the sun and say, okay, this is important.
I think one of the very important drivers has been the federal investment tax credit that has provided a 30% tax credit to households, commercial entities, and utility scale solar facilities, a very important element in moving a new energy technology forward. I think we're very accustomed to fossil fuel subsidies that have been in place for decades and go relatively unquestioned. Unfortunately, with an incentive like the tax credit, Congress is looking at it from year to year rather than decade to decade. But that is a factor. There have been a lot of progressive social policies that have been important drivers. In New York State, for example, your renewable portfolio standard setting a 29% by 2015 target for renewables is a very important driver. You're not very close to that target as far as I understand, but there are many states that have renewable portfolio standards, about 30 states plus the District of Columbia, and those renewable portfolio standards really get utilities focused on integrating renewables into their portfolios. Another very important factor is the use of net metered solar, so that individual homes like our home, individual businesses can produce solar energy on their rooftops and not worry about whether they can use all of the energy they're producing at that actual time. They can sell their surplus electrons back to the grid at the retail rate for power. So that provides a kind of even guarantee as to the full utilization of solar on our rooftops. It's been estimated that we could be getting a fifth of our total power supply nationwide from rooftops alone. So developing those possibilities is really a very important step.
You actually talk about this in the book of your own trials and tribulations of adopting a rooftop solar system on your home.
Yes. Well, we live in Massachusetts, and some people would say, well, Massachusetts, it's a cold, snowy state. And in fact, it was a very snowy weekend right before we installed our solar array. We installed the array. One of the great things actually about solar photovoltaics is they work better in colder weather. So in that sense, Massachusetts and New York are in a great position. We generate now about 75% of our total power needs for our home and also for a plug-in electric vehicle, a Ford C-Max. I'm happy to say that American car manufacturers are finally waking up and designing some sensible cars. And that's a great opportunity for us to feel like we're taking charge of our own power production and in our own way to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions that are heading us toward climate catastrophe.
One of the things that you address in the book, and I think it's interesting because piggybacking what you did in your home and what people are doing and popping up all over the country in putting these rooftop systems in place, is that entire communities have been doing this. And you write about this early in the book about local communities capturing the sun, as you write. And I'm curious as to how powerful that movement has become and how strong a lure that is for other communities to look and say, okay, this is what we can do.
One of the interesting things about solar is that it actually cuts across political lines to some degree. And what we've seen is that there are a number of communities that are really moving towards solar energy, not because they have progressive political leadership, but because those people see the importance of addressing the challenge of climate change. For example, Lancaster, California has a mayor named Rex Parris who has decided that solar energy is a priority, top priority for his municipality. He himself is a conservative Republican, but he acknowledges that climate change actually is a problem and that human beings are actually contributing to it. Every new residential unit that is built in his city has to have at least 1 kilowatt of solar capacity installed, either on it or in the neighborhood on a collective facility. So that's a great step. And his goal is to have his community be zero net energy. That is, it produces all of its own electric power from renewable sources in the very near future. There are other communities like that that are moving in the same kind of direction. And one other feature that I think is important on a community scale is that there's something called community solar, actually, or shared solar, which allows people who can't put solar on their roofs, either because the roof doesn't have the right orientation or because they can't afford to install a full solar system, it allows these people to buy shares in a community solar facility, which means a facility that is built that has subscribers. So, for example, in Colorado Springs, there is a solar farm that has about 600 subscribers. Some people own the equivalent of one solar panel, some own several, and they get the equivalent output deducted from their electric bills. That's a great way for people to feel like they can own a piece of this transformative technology without having to do so on their own homes. And again, renters, for example, might not have any access to rooftops at all.
Philip Borberg is the author of Harness the Sun, America's Quest for a Solar-Powered Future. As I mentioned in the introduction, and we've been talking a lot about how this movement is forming and gaining great strength, but as you point out in the book, there are certainly great threats to the future of solar as well.
There are, and again, it has to do with, in part, the reluctance of Congress to enact the right and sustain the right kinds of support. But there's also a great deal of anxiety on the part of utilities pertaining to distributed solar generation. That is to say, when I am generating kilowatt hours in my home, my utility is not able to charge me for those kilowatt hours. And utilities are getting increasingly concerned that their rate base is going to shrink and that they are going to be in a tougher bind going forward. The answer to that is that utilities really have to redefine their role, not so much as pumping lots of kilowatt hours into the grid, as to provide electric services that are needed. Those services might be storage. Those services might be what's called demand response, where people use different facilities at the right times when there is a sufficient amount of solar energy available, for example. Utilities have to, frankly, take a lesson from the book of Kodak and Polaroid and other companies that failed to see that technology was transforming rapidly and that they needed to adapt or they would fail. And that is beginning to happen. A bunch of utilities are really recognizing the very important role that solar energy can play. And again, because of state mandates, they are moving in that direction, whether they're embracing solar or not. But we're definitely in a very important transitional moment where we've been relying upon very large central station power plants for decades and decades. Those power plants are great at churning out electricity. They're also great at churning out a lot of pollution. And we really need to move in a very different direction if America is going to become a leader rather than a laggard in addressing the challenge of climate change.
Those who support solar say that it is possible by the year of 2050 that this nation could draw a third of our electricity from the sun. How realistic is that?
I think that's entirely realistic. Technologically, it certainly could happen. The question is, will the right policy priorities be followed? The National Renewable Energy Laboratory, which is a government laboratory dedicated to studying renewable resources, came out with a study called Renewable Electricity Futures, and it estimated that we could be getting a half of our electricity from the sun and the wind by 2050 using technology that's commercially available today. So if you imagine this technology evolving in the coming decades, becoming more efficient, one could easily see that number going up very significantly. I think a third is within our reach, certainly.
It's hard to believe that we still are debating this, but when it comes to climate change, we look at this and we question this, and meanwhile, TikTok, things are changing quite rapidly. Do you think we're going to see a point where, I guess my question is, if not this, what? If this doesn't change, if the information that's coming in doesn't change our habits, what will?
I hate to think of what will. I mean, do we have to wait for the true ravages of climate change to hit us in a much more significant way? Are we going to turn a blind eye when various coastal nations find themselves engulfed and suffering more egregiously than we will? I hope we will wake up and recognize the magnitude of this challenge long before we're beyond the tipping point in terms of climate disaster. And that was part of my motivation for writing this book, to point to one technology that can play a very important role in steering us away from that kind of disaster. I want to mention just one other aspect of solar energy that I think is very important.
Yes.
In a state like New York, where there's a good amount of industrial property, and that is what's called brownfield solar. Building solar on industrial properties or contaminated sites, they might be landfills, they might be industrial zones, they might be former factories, they might be mining areas. The EPA has studied the solar potential of those sites in America. It's looked at 66,000 different sites, and it is estimated that we could be getting about 7 times our total household needs from solar energy installed on those brownfield sites alone. Now, I'm not even talking about the vast open spaces where we could be achieving huge multiples of our total electricity need from the sun. I'm talking about lands that are really, frankly, not very desirable for other purposes that we can repurpose for renewable energy generation.
And actually, if I remember this correctly, in the book you write that New Jersey is actually a leader in this.
New Jersey's doing very well. It's sort of interesting that New Jersey is a very small, crowded state, yet it is number 3 in the nation in cumulative solar electric generating capacity. Massachusetts, also not a very big state, is number 6, and New York is number 8. So New York has a way to go because you're a larger state. You've got more resources that you could be devoting to this, and the challenge is there, the opportunities are there, and the question is, will New York rise to the occasion? You've got some great programs in place. Governor Cuomo has dedicated $1 billion to New York Sun to create a megawatt block incentive program over the next decade, and hopefully you're going to see some significant development of solar within the state.
The name of the book is Harness the Sun, America's Quest for a Solar-Powered Future. It is published by Beacon Press. Philip Warburg, thank you very much for joining us this morning. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Again, title of the book, Harness the Sun. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.